Welcome to the New Life Podcast, a ministry of New Life Presbyterian Church in Ithaca, New York. Join us for worship each week at 10 o'clock at 950 Danby Road, Ithaca, New York. You can also visit us on our website, www.newlifeithaca.org.
Hello and welcome to the Midweek Podcast, an occasional supplement to the Sunday sermon at New Life Presbyterian Church. This week, I preached on one of my favorite texts, the text of Thomas and Jesus in John chapter 20. Where I went with it this time was to talk about issues of deconstruction and doubt and reasons to believe. The basic argument that I presented was that in the same way that Jesus presents his hand and his side to Thomas, we're also presented with reasons to believe in this created world. In the sermon, I argued that recent developments in our knowledge of the universe are an example of that extension of the side and the wounds of Jesus to us. They are parts of the creation that can help us believe. They show us that God is real. Now, the reason why I'm doing a midweek podcast is because I got several questions about this after church, had some great discussions. Some are still to come. But I also wanted to make sure that the argument that I was presenting was laid out in a little more systematic manner, because I wasn't able to do so as much in a sermon, and a sermon is not what that's for. So I want to go through this a little more detail. I talked about an argument from the size of the universe. Now, I'm going to preface this by talking about an argument against God based on the size of the universe. This was an argument that New Atheist had presented about 10 years ago or so. People like, not Carl Sagan, this was from 1990, his quotation that I'll read to you in a second, but Victor Stenger, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and others have argued that we are such a small part of this insignificant universe. How can we possibly imagine that our little tiny place was the subject of God's interest, if God exists, or the universe's interest? Therefore, our version of theism is wrong. Just to give you a couple of quotes here. From Carl Sagan in 1990, "Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity and all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere save us from ourselves." Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's seen often as the 21st century heir apparent, heir to Carl Sagan, often says that we are a speck on a speck on a speck on a speck. You probably need a few more specks there because of the huge vastness of the universe. But deGrasse Tyson gets his point across. We are very, very small. We also have a New Atheist named Victor Stenger, who wrote this: "The picture of the multiverse today starts with our own visible universe of 100 billion galaxies." Actually, it's way more than that. "Each containing 100 billion stars, 13.8 billion years old. Besides that, we also have the eternal multiverse containing an unlimited number of other bubble universes of comparable size. Surely then, it is ludicrous to think that humanity is a special creation of a divinity that presides over this vast reality. Well, first of all, the multiverse is a hypothesis. We have no evidence for it. The multiverse is a way to explain how we got here, of course, because if there are infinite multiverses, then it increases the odds of the infinitesimally small odds that we exist in at all, because there's a bunch of them. But again, there's no observable evidence for a multiverse that I've ever heard. It's interesting also from this quote by Stenger that he's mentioning that there are 100 billion galaxies, but in the past 10 years, we know that there's far more than 100 billion galaxies. Indeed, some recent estimates state that there are up to 2 trillion galaxies. And that's just in the past 10 years that we've updated those numbers that Stengel was quoting. Now, is this an argument against the existence of God, or an argument against the hubris of human beings? I think it is obvious that it is an argument against the hubris of human beings, that we should be humble due to our smallness in this universe. But is that an argument against the existence of God, really? I remind you that 3,000 years ago, David wrote in Psalm 8, "What is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him?" David saw that humanity is very, very small without the advancements of modern science. Of course, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, we believe. So if our faith, our religion, Judeo-Christian writings in the Hebrew Scriptures have stated this very idea that human beings are very small and should not be prideful, in fact, we should be humble, then how is it an argument against the existence of God if our very faith contains this sentiment? Indeed, given what we know about how unlikely it is that life as we have it on this planet would exist, it would seem that the existence of life, complex as it is on our planet anywhere, would be solitary. Estimates of the odds of life existing as it does on our planet, not unicellular as it may exist in other places, recent observations of distant planets that reveal certain compounds that can only be produced, at least according to our scientific knowledge, by certain algae, have been discovered, so possible evidence of life elsewhere, but unicellular. But estimates of the odds of life, complex life as it exists on our planet existing, are 1 in 1 times 10 to the 24th power, which is a septillion. That's a very small number. So if the odds of this happening are 1 in 1 septillion, how many stars are there in the universe? Well, according to the estimate that I just gave you, there are about 1 septillion stars. So how many stars would you expect would have a planet in its habitable range that develop complex life according to those odds? 1. So is that an argument against the existence of God, or is it actually keeping with the scientific knowledge of the odds of life existing? Maybe that doesn't move the needle for you. But that doesn't even count the odds that this universe would exist at all. According to Stephen Hawking, in a quote that I'll read to you in just a moment, the expansion of the universe happened at such a fine-tuned rate just seconds after the Big Bang that if it was 1/100 billionth of a fraction larger or smaller, we wouldn't exist. Smaller, it would implode on itself. Larger, it would expand too fast for anything to come together. Indeed, the fine-tuning of the universe is such that the odds of us existing even as a planetary body, not even as life, are infinitesimally small. So is the size of the universe really an argument against God? It certainly is an argument for the humility of humanity. On the contrary, I argue that the size of the universe can be an argument for the existence of God. As I mentioned in the sermon, one of the main objections to God existing is implausibility. Now, that may seem like a tautological argument. I can't believe that something like God can exist, so I don't believe. Again, I don't believe because I don't believe. That seems to be tautological. But nevertheless, one of the problems that we have mentally wrapping our head around God is the incredulity that an infinite, eternal, omnipotent, invisible God is plausible. I've seen people online talk about your sky God, you know, your fairy God, things like that. It's unbelievable, right? And a bigger part of this question, as Neil deGrasse Tyson put it in a video that I will put in the show notes, where did God come from? But the question, where did God come from? Where did the infinite God come from that I just described? Begs the question, where did the infinite or practically infinite universe come from? As I mentioned in the sermon, this universe is so large it is difficult to fathom. The power contained in all the stars in this universe is so great it is difficult to fathom. Both the size and the power of the universe are practically infinite. They are larger than we can imagine. And yet, we can observe it. We can observe these things and know that the universe is very, very large, very, very powerful, practically infinite according to our minds. So this begs the question, where did God come from? Begs the question, where did the universe come from? Both questions have equal implausibility attached to them. If one of the problems we have with the existence of God is, where did God come from? We have the equally difficult problem, where did the universe come from? Because if there isn't a God who created the universe, then we have an practically infinite universe that didn't have a beginning and doesn't have a source. It just always was. If we have no problem believing in that, a universe without causation, a universe without source of being, we shouldn't have a problem with another entity also having no beginning or source of being. And so for that reason, I argued that belief in an eternal universe without source and without cause, and belief in an eternal God without source or cause, both those beliefs are equally plausible. Neither is more plausible than the other. Now, someone may argue, we can observe the universe, we can't observe God. That's true. But that doesn't take away the problem of where did the universe come from. That problem exists whether we can observe it or not. And so as a solution to the problem, where did the universe come from? Someone posits there was an eternal being that created it. The problem of source and the problem of eternality exists for both. And so I say they're equally plausible. As Neil deGrasse Tyson said in the same little video that I will post, and it's very short, if you want to argue that God is the source of the Big Bang, the singularity, I'm fine with that. He actually said that. I'm fine with that. Because he also understands it's equally plausible as far as what we know and what we can observe. We can't observe the beginning of the universe. We can observe the Big Bang, but we can't observe the source of it. We can't observe the eternality of it. Neil deGrasse Tyson admits it's equally plausible that God created it, whoever God is. So from an equally plausible position, both the eternal universe or the eternal God being the source of all things, I then argue from the fine-tuning and implausibility of both the universe existing and of life existing without a creator. There's a quote by Stephen Hawking in Return of the God Hypothesis by Stephen Meyer. Hawking originally wrote this in The Brief History of Time about the fine-tuning of the natural world and how improbable that it exists. Hawking said, "It would be very difficult to explain why the universe should have begun in just this way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us. In fact, if one considers the possible constants and laws that could have emerged, the odds against a universe that has produced life like ours are immense. Why did the universe start out with so nearly the critical rate of expansion that separates models that recollapse from those that go on expanding forever? That even now, 10,000 million years later, it is still expanding at nearly the same critical rate. If the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang had been smaller even by one part in 100,000 million million, the universe would have collapsed before it ever reached its present size." Now, Hawking's quote is important because some may argue that the universe sort of fine-tuned itself over time. But he says 1 second, and probably an instant, less than a second, after the Big Bang, it was so finely tuned that if it was 100,000 millionth of off in its constant of expansion, the universe wouldn't have formed. That is a very, very, very tiny percentage. But add to that the implausibility of life that we've already said has been estimated to be 1 × 10^24 power, or 1 in 1 septillion. The odds that we are here are so very small that it strains credulity that we are here. And so, isn't it reasonable to posit that an intelligent, eternal, all-powerful, infinite being created it? Again, if the source of the universe itself being infinite or the source of the universe being God are equally plausible, then doesn't it add to the plausibility of God being the creator the infinitesimally small odds that we should be here? I think so. Thomas Aquinas articulated several arguments for the existence of God. I find two of them to be particularly persuasive. His argument from efficient causes states that every cause has a cause. Every action has a cause. And therefore, there has to be a cause for every action. And so if you go back from to the beginning, if there is a beginning, again, if the universe isn't infinite itself, then at the very beginning, there had to be a cause of the beginning. And that's where we come to with the Big Bang. What caused it? Without a first cause, there'd be no other causes. Therefore, the first cause is God. That's ultimately where we get in this argument, where Neil deGrasse Tyson sort of says, if you want to believe that, I'm fine with it. But we also have the argument from necessary being. I find this argument also to be persuasive. And this is that being comes from being. Being doesn't come from nothing. Right? So everything that is had to come from something else that also is. The argument goes, objects in the world come into existence and pass out of it. It is possible for those objects to exist or not exist in any particular time. However, nothing came from nothing. This means something must exist at all times. In other words, if the observable universe is finite, and it is, there's no evidence of this universe being infinite, infinitely eternal. And so, if we go back to the very beginning, and there's no source of being, it actually makes sense that there is an eternal source of being somewhere. Now that gets us back to the original argument. Is the universe the eternal source of being, or is God the eternal source of being? Adding to the argument from causes, where did the first event, what caused it, or this argument from necessary being, where did the original being get its essence or being from? Adding to that the implausibility of this universe existing, to the implausibility of life existing on this planet, I think makes the argument for God the most reasonable answer. Adding to this, though, the beauty and the awe and transcendence we see in this universe. What was interesting is that in some of the quotes from Carl Sagan, from Neil deGrasse Tyson and others about the size of the universe, the way they describe it transcendently. They are in awe at the size of the creation, at its immensity, at its power, at its beauty. Where does that beauty come from? Does beauty exist just because? Does it just naturally exist, or does beauty have to come from something? One of the laws of thermodynamics is that the universe tends toward disorder. If we know this to be true, that entropy is a thing, that the universe tends toward disorder, how do things become more orderly? How does ugliness turn into beauty? How does beauty even exist, and goodness and awe and transcendence? If you add these to the God hypothesis, it even adds more credulity to it. Richard Dawkins has a quote along these lines. And this is from A River Out of Eden, A Darwinian View of Life. He says, the total amount of suffering per year in the natural world is beyond all decent contemplation. During the minute that it takes me to compose this sentence, thousands of animals are being eaten alive. Many others are running for their lives, whimpering with fear. Others are slowly being devoured from within by rasping parasites. Thousands of all kinds are dying of starvation, thirst, and disease. And it must be so. If there was ever a time of plenty when these things didn't happen, this very fact would automatically lead to an increase in the population until the natural state of starvation and misery is restored, because there's too many of them. Not enough food. Not enough space. In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces, and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no good, no evil, nothing but pitiless indifference. And yet, he describes something that we are to think of as bad. Animals being eaten alive. the contrary is that, yes, there are things in the universe that are sad, but there are also things that are beautiful and indescribably happy and joyful, like the birth of a child or the love between two people or any number of other things that bring beauty into the world. Those things exist too. And according to the hypothesis that the universe is eternal and there is no God, none of those things have meaning. The beauty doesn't have meaning. The good doesn't have meaning. It's not beautiful. It's not good. But neither does the suffering have any meaning. There is no meaning. There's just pitiless indifference. Add to this the culmination of where this is all going, and it may go further, but this is at least the culmination of where I've seen it go recently in my studies of this issue. A Stanford biologist by the name of Robert Sapolsky, and this was in the New York Times in October of 2023. I'll put it in the show notes. Wrote a book against free will, saying free will does not exist. It is a fantasy. There is no free will, according to Robert Sapolsky, a recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant. In his latest book, Determined, A Science of Life Without Free Will, Dr. Sapolsky confronts and refutes the biological and philosophical arguments for free will. He contends that we are not free agents, but that biology, hormones, childhood, and life circumstances coalesce to produce actions that we merely feel were ours to choose. In a provocative claim, he concedes. It is a provocative claim, he concedes, but he would be content if readers simply began to question the belief which is embedded in our cultural conversation. Getting rid of free will completely strike us of our sense of identity and autonomy and where we get meaning from. There are major implications of this, he notes. Absent free will, no one should be held responsible for behavior, good or bad. Dr. Sapolsky sees this as liberating for most people, for whom life has been about being blamed and punished and deprived and ignored for things they have no control over. This is where the atheistic hypothesis leads. There is no good, there is no evil, there is no beauty. There is no meaning in beauty, there is no meaning in suffering either. There is no free will, which means there is no one who is responsible for their actions. There's no justice. We're all just a set of cells that react according to our nurture and according to our chemical reactions in our bodies. This is where it all goes. And if we're evaluating the God hypothesis of theism versus atheism, I think this also lands us philosophically more in the God side. No free will, no choice, no accountability. The atheist position gives us nothing positive, and it does not account for the likelihood of the existence of the universe we have. And it still has the problem of the theist position of where it came from. So the theist position is more reasonable and much more satisfactory position to hold. If it's equally plausible that the universe is eternal and there is no God, that they're equally plausible with that there is a God who created the universe, all these other factors add to the credibility of the God hypothesis being true. Can we be certain? No. I'm certainly not arguing that. Is it reasonable to believe? Yes. Is it more likely? Yes. Can this be something that helps to quell our doubts? I think so. It has certainly helped to quell mine. The other factors to talk about, these are logical arguments, scientific arguments, philosophical arguments. And as I mentioned in the sermon, also in discussions outside with members of the congregation, you can't argue someone into the kingdom of God. You cannot argue someone into faith. you cannot present logical arguments that will cause someone to believe in God. In the text itself, Jesus tells Thomas to reach out his hand, and then he commands him to believe. Therefore, we're able to present each other with proofs that will maybe help our minds. But in order for our souls to be changed, the call of Christ has to come. Stop believing and believe. The call of Christ coming into someone's life is essential for anyone to believe. But what I'm trying to argue here on this podcast and a little bit in the sermon, to help our minds, to help our doubts, is that that belief is reasonable. And it's not only reasonable, it is the most likely explanation to how we got here.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Please rate and review us on your podcast service and share with anyone who may be interested. The intro and outro music for the New Life podcast is provided by Sandra McCracken with her permission. Please visit her website at sandramccracken.com. We'll see you next week.